Welcome to Advanced Nuclear, the official podcast of UCAN Power, where leading experts, innovators, and policymakers explore the latest developments shaping the future of nuclear energy.
Welcome to the Advanced Nuclear Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Howe, on behalf of UCAN Power. We're here to talk about bringing cutting-edge nuclear technologies to the civil power market to bolster our national and energy security. The advanced nuclear industry is broad and deep with 1,000 different aspects, advanced fuels, reactor deployment models, new reactor design, safety, security, nonproliferation, the interaction with AI, external engagement, financing, the list goes on. We've covered many of these topics in previous episodes, and we hope you can go back and listen to any you may have missed. It's rare that a single person has been involved in these many aspects of the advanced nuclear industry, but today we have a special guest who has done pretty much that. He's seen and done it all. He has a unique view of the industry, having served in a variety of nuclear-related roles in government and now in the private sector, where he juggles a number of key responsibilities. Tim Frazier is a veteran of the Department of Energy, where he's worked in nonproliferation, spent fuel disposition and storage, is a senior technical advisor to the Assistant Secretary for Nuclear Energy on space-based power systems and in a variety of other roles. In the private sector, he's worked with GE Hitachi on the Natrium reactor, with Zeno Power as they develop new radioisotope systems, with ALLO, a startup company rapidly bringing their reactor technology to market, and with several other companies. Further, he sits on the board of directors for UCAN Power, where we benefit from his decades of experience. It's fair to say that Tim has pretty much seen it all, and we're lucky to have him on the show. So, Tim, thanks for taking the time to join us on the Advanced Nuclear Podcast. We really appreciate you being here.
It's my pleasure, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
Great. Well, let's just start at the beginning. You know, what led you to a career in the nuclear world?
So when I got out of college, I started working at the Mound Weapons Plant just south of Dayton, Ohio. And I worked on the nuclear weapons side. So this was in the early 90s, very early 90s. When the wall came down, 91, 92, the nuclear weapons industry kind of went south. Thankfully, not opposed to that, but I had to find something else to do. And I was dabbling a little bit in radioactive waste management because Mound was a cleanup site at that point. Once the weapons were done, they went into full environmental restoration. I had an old dear friend, kind of a mentor, who worked on, I was a Fed, he worked on the contractor side. And this position came open in the PU-238 program, which built RTGs for NASA, other users, managed out of the Office of Nuclear Energy. And he said, well, Tim, would you rather say that you were in waste management or that you were working on, you know, plutonium-238 power systems that were going to go into deep space? I said, okay, I like the latter. And that really is what got me started into the nuclear side. It focused in the first years on specifically plutonium-238 RTGs and some Stirling systems, but that's what started it.
Okay, so these systems, you know, we've used them in spacecraft for NASA and for other uses. Can you talk just a little bit, you know, how do RTG systems work? You know, why they're important? You know, what's the current state of the art of these technologies?
So the current state of the art of RTGs is about the same as where it was. Silicon germanium unicouples are designed to operate in a vacuum. So for the deep space systems, these are like the ones that flew on Cassini that I built early in my career, and the one that flew on the mission to Pluto, which was the last one I was responsible for before I got involved in DGNEP, which we're probably going to talk about in a minute. But typically it's 6.5-7% conversion for thermoelectrics. So an RTG just takes the thermal energy from the decay of the plutonium-238, turns it into electricity just by thermoelectric conversion, and you get about 6.5 or 7% of the thermal wattage turned into electric. It's not terribly efficient. There are other efficient systems, but they haven't been proven to have such long life. So they're used in harsh and remote. This is what we used to say at the department. RTGs are for harsh and remote environments. And then we never really had to clarify what harsh and remote were, but it was kind of a given.
So basically, you're sending a spacecraft way into deep space, away from the sun. You lose your ability to use solar panels because just the you know, the distance from the sun, it's
correct.
The the square of the distance, that sort of thing. So
and if you think about, if you know, Pluto, the mission to Pluto was launched in January of 06. It didn't arrive, well, it didn't arrive, it flew by Pluto. It wasn't an orbiter at all. 9.5 years later, so it didn't get there until like August of 2015, the summer of 2015. I don't remember the exact date, but it was a long voyage. It's a far, far way out to try to do that with, you know, solar panels. It's just not happening.
So the bottom line is these RPS, these radioisotope power systems, they enable us to do some deep space exploration that otherwise we couldn't do. Is that a good way to sum it up?
That's perfect. Said it better than I could.
So plutonium-238, of course, anything plutonium is, you know, going to bring some controversy, and some people are going to oppose it. I know Cassini, there's a lot of protest down at the Cape Canaveral. That's that thing. People worried about that. It's very safe. We've never had real serious problems with that. But there's other isotopes that can be used for radioisotope power systems. I know with Zeno Power, you've been looking at some different isotopes. What are these isotopes, and are they available, and what's the state there?
So Zeno, who I left G. Itachi in October of 21 to join, they're focusing on strontium-90. Because it's kind of a byproduct of you know, spent nuclear fuel fissions. There is quite a supply of it. The Department of Energy has quite a lot of it. They view it as waste, and Zeno doesn't. They view it as something very valuable that they can, you know, take the heat from the decay of the strontium-90 as well, and fabricate systems. The thing about strontium-90, as I'm sure everybody knows, it's the brimstrahlin radiation from the beta decay can be kind of severe at times. There requires still a lot of shielding. One of the things that we were able to do while I was still working with them full time, I'm more of a consultant now to the CEO, Tyler Bernstein. While I was there, we were able to get a grant from NASA, an agreement in place with NASA that's called Tipping Point, and it's to transition like TRL technology readiness level 2 or 3 to like a 6, TRL 6. Then the next step would be 7, 8, and then launch, TRL 7, 8, and then launch. That system, we're looking at americium. Americium is an alpha decay. It's got a little bit of a gamma you got to take care of, but it's a 400 plus year half-life. But it generates heat as it decays. And so moving to that seems to be where the industry is trying to go. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of it in the United States. What little we have is produced by Los Alamos, recovered, not produced, recovered from plutonium supplies up there, and sold by the Isotope Production Office out of Office of Science at DOE. The British and the French have a lot of it that comes out of their reactor grade. They have a lot of it in their stockpile of reactor grade plutonium that they've separated over the years. So that's really going to be the big source. And, you know, that's really the only, you know, Western source of americium, but it's out there. It can be available.
So you mentioned these harsh and remote applications. I know there's even some we probably can't talk about on this podcast, but, you know, things that could be undersea and, you know, remote weather stations where all you need is just, you know, a small source of power, because we're not talking, you know, kilowatts here, right? With RPS. Watts or tens of watts or hundreds of watts.
Yeah. The most power that we've launched of an RTG system, there were three on Cassini. And they were each about, I don't know, 300 watts, something like that. That was 900 watts. And that was a bunch of plutonium. I mean, Each one of those RTGs probably had 8 or 9 kilograms of plutonium-238 isotope. So it took a lot of 238 to get it up to the ability just to get below a kilowatt, not even a real kilowatt. So it's not, when you get above a kilowatt, it's going to be difficult with isotopes. Unless, of course, I should say, there will be people out there that will immediately put their hand up and say, well, what about Stirling systems? Well, Stirling systems, they're about 25-ish percent conversion. So 4 times better than thermoelectrics, but still it's a lot of plutonium or any other radioisotope, thermal radioisotope to launch.
Right. And so when you go to the bigger power levels, whether it's for, you know, just providing power to a spacecraft or maybe a settlement on Mars or the moon, as well as nuclear space propulsion, there's been a lot of talk about that. What are your thoughts about those two uses? I mean, these are not RTGs anymore. These are, you know, actually nuclear rocket engines or small reactors that you could put up in space. Where do you see that going in the next decade or so?
Well, I think that we are going to have some kind of demonstration for the space power systems. If you want to go to the moon, my opinion, if you want to go to the moon and spend any amount of time reliably, they're going to need some kind of fission surface power. And, you know, NASA had a program, and I don't know if it's still ongoing, but it was being slow. It was slow to evolve, let me say that, for fission surface power. There have been, you know, nuclear thermal propulsion people have talked about. They've talked about NEP, nuclear electric propulsion, but all of those are reactor based. You can't get the kind of specific powers that you would need using RTGs. So yeah, there's a place for it. And there are, you know, a handful of companies that are working very diligently on putting nuclear reactor into space and preparing one that could be deployed on the lunar surface.
Well, that I think is going to be essential if we're going to, you know, have humans up there for more than just a few hours or a night that we, like we have with the Apollo program, where they did use RTGs, you know, for very small.
They did. Yeah.
But to power a moon base of any sort, you just are going to have a real hard time with solar up there. And, you know, that moon dust, as you kick it around, is very pernicious. It just gets on top of everything. And so there's some great stories about the Apollo astronauts when they'd get back into the lunar capsule, and they were covered with this dust. So it's going to make it hard for solar. And plus, there's a lot of places on the moon where we want to go, where there might be water, for example, frozen water at the, you know, ice at the southern pole there. And that's the thing, where you just don't have the ability to do solar power. So I think having a small reactor is the only way to go.
And I should add that my impression has always been, or my position has always been, you're going to have some kind of stable radioisotope driven power on the moon to augment the, if it's fission surface power, or, you know, on Mars, if it's Mars, you would be better off than on the moon. But if, you know, these reactors that we're going to deploy on the lunar surface are not going to have a 95% reliability or capacity factor, which is what we talk about with light water reactors in the U.S. I think the best year we ever had was like a 96% capacity factor with the reactors, the light water reactors in the United States. So now I'm going to take this new reactor, I'm going to put it on the moon, and I can't expect that its capacity factor on the moon is going to be better than 96%. So now you've got, you know, astronauts living on the moon. Every 14 days, it gets cold, as cold can get. And you're going to have some, in my opinion, some radioisotope systems available just for life support if the reactor goes down. So it's just, there's still a place for radioisotopes. There's definitely a place for fission power. It's an exciting time for both industries, actually.
So you just made a really important point that I don't think I've ever heard anyone else say, at least publicly, is that, you know, having a reactor on the moon is a good solution for providing power to a settlement, but you better have a backup system in place.
Yeah.
And RTG is the way to go, set of RTGs. That makes, because it's a time-tested technology. We've been using them for decades and decades.
Yeah.
We know how to do it. That makes a lot of sense, just to ensure that we don't have any calamitous events happen on the moon. But okay, well, you know, your expertise in that realm is pretty amazing. But you've done a lot of other things. One of the really interesting programs that you were part of when you were at DOE was the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, GNEP. Yeah. It was during the Bush administration. It came up. But can you talk a little bit about, you know, how GNEP was created, why it was created, and, you know, whatever happened to it?
So I mentioned the January 06 launch of the mission to Pluto. When I came, I was in Washington then. I moved to Washington in August of 03. When we came back from the launch in January of 06, early in February, I got a call to code downtown to the Forrestal building. And it was, hey, we're rolling out the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership and President Bush's 07 budget request. So this was February 06 for the 07 budget request going to Congress. And we need somebody to run it for the next, I don't know, 10 months or something like that. So I was kind of foisted into this Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, which hopefully people will Google it because it was really amazing. It was advanced reprocessing, essentially separating out the transuranics. It was a big fuel fabrication plant, and it was a big advanced burner reactor to burn the transuranics. And initially, we talked about it in the context of reducing the burden on Yucca Mountain, because the transuranics, I think particularly neptunium, were kind of a big problem for the million-year dose at Yucca Mountain. So this was back. You know, Yucca Mountain was going strong. The Office of Nuclear Energy at Forrestal was right next to OCRM, RW, the Office of Civilian Radioactive Waste Management in Forrestal. So we were, you know, closely aligned with them. It was a President Bush initiative. Clay Sell was the deputy secretary at the time, and was very, you know, forward leaning on the whole effort. You know, the global piece was huge. I mean, the idea was we would develop this proliferation resistant reprocessing, which was going to be difficult to push. But so its big thing was to expand nuclear power widely. By the way, I think, if I go back and I look at the early stuff in GNEP in the 06, 07 timeframe, it's like the first time that you'll see kind of SMR-ish type language coming out of the administration, the Bush administration, at least. So it was good. Everybody was on board. We had a bunch of big meetings. This was back when, once they hired a great guy out of Los Alamos, Dr. Lisowski, to run it, probably after the beginning of the fiscal year. So the beginning of the next year, I started working for Dennis Spurgeon as a senior technical advisor, which got me entwined and involved in a lot more. But I never really left GNEP because there was, you know, white papers that had to be written. There were, you know, talking points had to be generated. There were meetings over at the White House. There were, you know, interagency reviews that we had to deal with. So it was exciting. And what happened to it is whenever McCain lost the election, Obama essentially, they defunded all of it except for the international component. So, you know, Ed McGinnis ran the international piece for us back in the day for GNEP, did a great job. And that piece kind of kept on. There's an ongoing effort that's kind of morphed from GNEP into the new stuff. So it's ongoing. You know, it's interesting, you know, these days, GNEP kind of coming back a little bit, not the global piece, but when you think about some of the advanced sodium reactors, some of the advanced fast reactors that are sodium cool, are interested in burning transuranics, and some of them have talked about recycling their fuel and putting it back into their reactor. Well, that's essentially what GNEP was going to do. We were going to take out the transuranics, keep the plutonium in there and put it back in. And that is essentially what some of these folks are talking about when they recycle their reactor, when they recycle their reactor fuel.
I mean, that all kind of makes a lot of sense to me. And we at UCAN Power have embraced the idea of recycling. I know there's a lot of controversy. The French, for example, use a process called Purex, where they actually are taking out a stream of plutonium, plutonium. But some of these transuranic processes like pyroprocessing, you actually get it all jumbled together. So it's not really a proliferation risk. It's really hot material, and you've got to do all this in hot cells, and it's hard to do. But the ability to reuse spent nuclear fuel over and over and over is a pretty compelling case to make. So we're wishing the best for these companies that are pursuing that with vigor. So
yeah, but me too. I think it would be a great opportunity. I mean, everybody knows there's a lot of energy left in the spent nuclear fuel. It's kind of a shame to dispose of it intact, but I mean, now we've got what, almost 90,000 metric tons of spent fuel around the country. To reprocess that all would take, a long time. Not that we couldn't do it. I mean, we could, but if we built, a 2,000 metric ton a year plant in the United States, it'll take 45 years. And during those 45 years, we're going to be making even more spent nuclear fuel. So it's kind of, anyway.
Well, you bring up spent nuclear fuel, so I've got to go there. We got to talk about the Blue Ribbon Commission, which was a big, Obama administration initiative, which a lot of folks were behind, but you were right in the midst of that. So, tell us about how you got into the Blue Ribbon Commission, what your role was, and what happened there.
So at the end of the Bush administration, I got to, I was kind of done with Forrestal. So I got to spend a little bit of time back out in Germantown for 9 months or so until the new assistant secretary showed up, a guy named Pete Miller. And then Pete decided that he needed somebody with the skill set that I had at the time back downtown to help him, in the front office of NE. So I went back down, and that was probably October, November of 2009. And then shortly after that, this whole Blue Ribbon Commission thing comes up. We've got this letter from Obama, directing Secretary Chu to do the Blue Ribbon Commission. Dan Poneman was the DepSec at the time. I knew Dan back in the early GNEP days, mainly because we were talking to him because he's kind of a non-pro person, wanted to just test the waters on GNEP with somebody who wasn't, drinking the Kool-Aid of GNEP, so to speak. And then it kind of spawned. I helped get the charter and everything set up and got all the commissioners kind of sworn in as special government employees. And then it came time to designate a designated federal official. And I got that gig. Not that I lobbied for it necessarily, but it was certainly a nice opportunity to be able to, spend 2 years working with the likes of Ernie Moniz and Allison McFarlane, and Senator Domenici was on the commission. Susan Eisenhower was on it. One of the best things that we did as the department, and I should say that Congressman Hamilton, Democrat, Indiana, was one of the chairs, And Brent Scowcroft was the other chair. So those were my two co-chairs. I didn't get too involved other than, you know, here are some people that we think would be good as a director of the folks putting the report together, doing the whole Blue Ribbon Commission charter. Because as the Fed, I was hands off. I was supposed to stay out, just facilitate, make sure everything that they had, everything they needed. So we hired John Kotek, which was a great decision. You know, if you don't know John, you should know John, because he's a great guy. He would be a good one, by the way, for one of your podcasts in the future. So John ran the commission team, which were a team of about four or five people, but it was the best 2 years. We traveled all over. We traveled to France. We traveled to the UK. We traveled to Japan. In fact, we were in Japan March of 2011. We were there in February of 2011. And then, of course, Fukushima was March. So it was really special. And, you know, the idea that it's so broad. And I encourage people, if they haven't seen the report, just go pick up the executive summary and read it. I think the executive summary might be 15, 20 pages, but it really is a great executive summary of what was two solid years of work. But it was a fabulous experience. I mean, it allowed me to grow in so many levels of just experience and knowledge base. And it was a nice way to kind of bring my career to a close, because at the end of it, it ended in January of 2012. We issued the report in February and March. We did kind of hearings and stuff on the Hill. And then in April, I took an early out and retired from DOE. So nice cap on my career with DOE.
So I've got to ask your opinion, and this is Tim's opinion. No ties to your government work, but you know, what is the best solution for dealing with these 90,000 plus tons of spent nuclear fuel? Is it reprocessing? Is it interim storage? Is it final deep geological storage? What do you think?
So I think it's going to be a mixture. You know, the older stuff is going to be easier to reprocess. Like I said a minute ago, you know, if we built, you know, a 2,000 metric ton plant, that will only keep up with what we, you know, what we generate in a typical year in the U.S. So I think there's going to have to be some deep geological disposal. Look, I'm a fan of retrievability. I think if we put it somewhere, we ought to be able to go get it for a while if we want it. You know, I was super supportive of our consent-based siting approach that came out of the Blue Ribbon Commission. I mean, we made a great trip over to Finland, talked to folks over there about how they were doing it. And then, you know, there was the big competition in Sweden on where they were going to put theirs. And so it was all, the spin was entirely different there than it was here, where here it was looked on something like, oh, I don't want to touch that. I don't want that in my state. You know, these provinces, I guess they're called in Sweden, were super excited to be in the competition. And, you know, the community that lost was sad. So it was really a different view of things. But I think, you know, I'm supportive of the department's continued work on consent-based siting. And by the way, we the Blue Ribbon Commission, I'll say it in the big we were not chartered to look at Yucca Mountain per se. In fact, you know, we had taken some flack at the beginning when the charter came out about not looking at Yucca Mountain. And, you know, I've made a few smart decisions in my career. And one of them was at the very first meeting of the Blue Ribbon Commission, having Secretary Chu come and be there in person to tell all those people, everybody, because it were open meetings, all the public, all the press, the 15 commissioners, and that, you know, Yucca Mountain was not in their purview. So that came directly from Secretary Chu. He chartered the Blue Ribbon Commission. And from then on, every time somebody was like, well, why aren't you looking at Yak Mountain? I'd be like, well, Secretary Chu directed us to not. Now, there's a great history because, you know, Yucca Mountains, the folly that had become Yucca Mountain is a great story kind of about how things can go wrong. So it's in the report. We did give it a bunch of review in the report in that regard. And by the way, the Blue Ribbon Commission report certainly doesn't exclude Yucca Mountain from any consideration. If the consent-based siting suddenly Nevada decided that they thought that it would be great to have and they wanted to participate in a consent-based siting process to put spent nuclear fuel at Yucca, it's certainly not precluded.
It's a really complex topic. It's something that is going to be with us for a while, I think. But there are some pretty unique concepts out there, whether it's, you know, deep borehole repositories, whether it's reprocessing and all of the above. So maybe that's the real solution, is it'll be a number of different things happening at the same time to kind of winnow down that 90,000 plus tons. But let's shift over something that you've been doing in the more recent years, and that is working with advanced reactor developers, the companies that are building. And you've worked with a whole bunch, you know, everything from GEH with the BWRX 300, which is a 300 megawatt electric light water reactor. And now you're with a company supporting a company called ALO, which is a much smaller, it's a sodium cooled reactor. Let's start with the small and with ALO. What's happening with the company, and you know, what exactly does their technology do that's special?
So I am the VP of government programs at ALO. It's my full-time gig. Super exciting company, and they are all about mass producing 10 megawatt electric systems. So thermally, they're like 30 megawatts thermal, but their goal is to build a 95% complete reactor assembly and ship it from the factory near the airport in Austin to wherever it's going to be installed. So we're switching the paradigm over. Well, I'm going to build a reactor at a site. Now we're building the reactor in a factory where we think we can make initially three or four 95% complete assemblies a month, and ship them wherever they need to go. We'll ship them to, you know, the base part of an existing structure. They'll be installed, and then we'll put the facility up around it. So, and by the way, we're sodium cooled, but we're thermalized. So we're, you know, thermal neutron spectrum. We're going to use LEU plus 8% ish material. We can order it now from Urenco, you know, GE, Hitachi, fuels, the fuel side, you know, they make BWR fuel every day of the week down in Wilmington, North Carolina. And then, you know, Framatome out towards Hanford, they can do similar work. So there are fuel fabricators that we can use. We're using just UO2 fuel, 8%. So they're really, our key thing is we're going to be able to make the reactors as quickly as we can. But they'll be shipped from our factory with, you know, NRC certified and stamped the whole nine yards. The facility and another thing I like is how quickly we're moving. We were given, in quotes, a piece of land just south of the materials and fuels complex out in Idaho that will house our ALO-X experimental reactor, which we're going to operate under DOE authorization. And DOE is entirely on board with this. Idaho National Laboratory is entirely on board that we will build this test reactor out there. We'll run some tests and some validations before we go into production of our ALO-1, which will be 10 megawatt electric. We found that people seem to like 50 megawatt increments. So we've developed an ALO-pod, which is five of these units. And we're excited to make our first commercial deployment, probably operational, we're hoping, Q4 of 29. Oh, I should say, AlloX, we will break ground for the facility in April of next year because we have to do some environmental assessment work, some NEPA work. And then we hope to be critical with AlloX in Q4 of 27. So we're moving fast. We've engaged the NRC. They seem committed, and people want to take advantage of the Advanced Act. So we're excited about it. It's I think we were also selected for the Texas A&M RELLIS site, along with a couple of other small reactors. So there's a lot of interest in Texas. I mean, it's a good time to have your headquarters in Texas. Because Texas is talking about a couple $1 billion nuclear energy fund that will be certainly supportive of not just us, but anyone, any of the others that are going to try to do development or deployment in Texas.
And that's where the state initiatives really come to play here. The federal government's done a great job with a lot of the ARDP and other programs,
Sure.
but it's the states are where these reactors are going to be located. And if you want to attract that business, especially when it comes to manufacturing, and so you've got the plant in Austin, and you can crank these things out, send them all over the country, maybe all over the world. One
Yep.
thing you said is very interesting is the concept of the allopod, where you link five or so of them together, and it seems to fit pretty nicely into this the size that these data center companies are looking for. Could you talk a little bit about that and how Allo and other companies might be well positioned to support, the expansion of data centers in the US?
Thanks for mentioning that. We have gotten a tremendous amount of interest from the data center folks, AI folks. They do like kind of the 50 megawatt electric increments because they can bring on their computational power, their whatever increment they're talking about. They can bring those on, and generally they're in 50 megawatt electric requirement. So, we can put so when we have our 50 megawatt electric Allopod on board, they've got the data center ready to go. And of course, I mean, their construction and operational dates will until we get up and rolling and can like really move these one after the other, they're going to be ahead of us in their capability at the site to do data center stuff. And then we'll follow on relatively quickly. We are looking at integrating very closely some in the in a the out years that can be more closely aligned. We'll start building in advance of the data center infrastructure showing up. It's really exciting. I mean, there it's huge. We have a lot of letters of interest, a lot of interest from the data center folks. Yeah, the 50 megawatts is a good site. And by the way, they need going back to, this is connection back to the reliability and capacity factor stuff. They need really high reliability as well. They don't want to be down. They're talking, four nines. Well, four nines is really hard for reactors and even for systems of reactors. Four nines is a tough number. We've talked about N plus one or N plus two configurations where they get 50 megawatts and maybe we install 70, so that the other two reactors can offset. We don't exactly haven't nailed down perfectly what our refueling rate is going to be. It could be 4-ish years. Like think about a month out of 4 years. If the reactor is going to be down, its capacity factor can't be any better than 98% because you're going to have to shut it down for four weeks. So it's a really interesting, it's an exciting effort.
And it sounds like this type of reactor would do well with the military bases. We've got this Advanced Nuclear Power for Installations program
Right.
that
Yep.
gives. So are you looking at that as well?
Yeah, we are. In fact, we have been talking to a couple Space Force bases. Think about remote bases that need, high reliability, high power. There certainly is a lot of interest. And we think that, well, we think that AI will open, once we demonstrate and once we have this capability, we think it's going to open a lot of doors. But it's also the other way around. If we can demonstrate at a military site, then the other folks will be like, oh yeah, here they go, or here they come, and they can really help, move things along. So yeah, definitely looking at, defense installations. And quite frankly, we haven't looked outside the country yet. There's so much focus in the U.S. on, data centers and nuclear energy, and the combination of those two things is, we frankly have as much as we can handle at the moment. Particularly with this announcement by, Secretary Wright, about looking at the DOE sites and the expansion of those DOE sites on federal land to do AI work, data center work that could be driven by nuclear. Now, nuclear is, if you look at it, nuclear is a small piece of what they're talking about. They're really just the RFI that they put out was really about what kind of infrastructure stuff would you have to have in order to put a data center on federal property. But hidden in there was this little piece about nuclear. So we think that's a great opportunity to, deal with the bigger nuclear sites, those that are nuclear friendly, in quotes, Hanford, and the proximity to the Columbia Generating Station out there. There's expertise that could help. Savannah River, with Vogtle across the river. Oak Ridge, obviously, they're big nuclear. So there's lots of opportunities.
And one of the concepts we at UCAN have been supporting is this idea of, deploying a single reactor is one thing, but when you start getting orders for multiple deployments or a small fleet, that really helps with a lot of logistical things and supply chain things and regulatory things. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that we at Olive are working very hard to establish our supply chains. We haven't placed an order yet for 8% material, but we're, in discussions with that. I should mention that OLO-X is, given that it's an experimental reactor and not a commercial unit, we're going to operate it on 5% fuel. So we're just going to go to GE or Framatome or somewhere and buy, 5% UO2 pellets and fuel it up and test it, because we can test all of our systems using 5% fuel. It's not a big deal. We're getting our NQA-1 program in place in Austin. We're developing all the procedures that we need down there to generate nuclear-grade hardware. Fueling is pretty straightforward for us. But I think regulatory-wise, hopefully license an Olo pod. So it'll be, five Olo ones. That's what the NRC license will be for, would be for the construction and operation of one Olo pod. And then we hopefully can just kind of cookie cutter that as we move forward. I think, the sense that I have at least is that NRC is trying very hard to be helpful these days. I don't know that it's better or worse than it has been. I think, Chairman Wright is a great guy to have, at the top of the NRC in these times, at least.
Yeah, I think we agree violently on that. It's a lot of good progress has been made, and this whole initiative to try to really whittle down the time it takes to, license an advanced reactor, especially the smaller reactors. And there's a lot of push now. If it's, less than 50 megawatts or some size, pick your size. You don't need as thorough of a scrutiny, as long as they're inherently safe, that sort of thing. So a couple of kind of wrap up questions. One is, where do you see the advanced nuclear industry writ large 5 years from now? Where are we going to be?
Oh, I think you'll see, Kairos, Oklo, Olo, we'll all be right there. Hopefully, it's still a very strong support, that we have in nuclear now, will continue as I think it will. I mean, I lived through the first nuclear renaissance was, which was back in the 06, 07, and 08 time frame, whenever there were what, over 30 COLA applications at NRC, and NRC was hiring every engineer they could find. A lot of people nowadays are talking about a renaissance, and I'm like, oh, geez, don't say renaissance. Let's let this play out. But it's super exciting. If this momentum continues, for the next 4 years, I mean, we've got, while President Trump's in the office, we've got plenty of support for nuclear. Secretary Wright, obviously, very supportive. Ted Gerrish, who was nominated for NE1, the Assistant Secretary for Nuclear Energy, great longtime supporter of nuclear energy. So I think everything's aligned. I mentioned Chairman Wright, great guy, super supportive of nuclear. So I think everything is lined up for it to be a success. Oh, I should mention, ARDP, those units are going to be coming online, probably not in the next 5 years, but 6 or 7, maybe. All depends. I'd like to see them come online before 2030. And by the way, I don't know what their schedules is, so I probably shouldn't even say, but they're big SMRs. There's a place, by the way, for, I'm sure that somebody's going to build another AP1000 sooner or later in the United States. It might be a while, but they're, where you've got large grids that need a lot of energy, they're going to require different things. SMRs, micros like us, 10 megawatt electric base system, 50 megawatt pod, there are places for all of those. Look, there are places for Radiant, there are places for, all the other kind of smaller, oh, eVinci, another great reactor. So I think the, I mean, it's a full field of horses for sure. But I think there's room for everybody at this point.
Well, those are great words of wisdom. So, as we wrap up, what's the one thing you want our listeners to take away from this conversation?
Take away that the nuclear industry is alive and well, and that a lot of people are working very hard to bring nuclear power back to the United States to re-exert our leadership in this area. We'll figure out what to do with the waste. Don't let the waste issues stop you from doing anything. I mean, there's a solution. There's multiple solutions. And if you're putting something on the moon, you're going to need some backup energy.
Got it. Well, this was a really enjoyable and informative conversation, Tim. I mean, you've really, run the gamut of everything from back end to front end to the new advanced reactor community that's coming out. So thanks so much for being here, and best wishes to you in all your various endeavors.
Great. Thanks, Jim. Always a pleasure. Great talking to you.
All right. Well, Tim, thank you so much. That's a wrap for this edition of the Advanced Nuclear Podcast. At UCAN Power, we believe that advanced nuclear technologies are key to powering the American economy in the years and decades ahead. So if you feel the same or want to learn more, just check us out at www.ucanpower.org. A special thanks to the team at UCAN Power and our producer, Ms. Kimberly, for her stellar work in making this podcast happen. She's a terrific professional and makes the whole thing come together with ease. So until next time, this is your host signing off with thanks to you for tuning in to the Advanced Nuclear Podcast.